Whoa, Miss Slippy. The part of the story I don't like is that the little boy gave up looking for Happy after an hour. He didn't put up posters or anything. He just sat on the porch like a goon and waited. That little boy's gotta think. You got a pet. You got a responsibility. If your dog gets lost, you don't look for an hour and then call it quits. You get your ass out there and you find that fucking dog! Hello, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to the Adam Sandler Cinematic Universe. I'm your host, Devin Decker, and joining me, my co-curator for this journey into the world of Adam Sandler's cinematic universe, Sejun Sarawik. Sejun?
Hi, Devin. Thank you for having me here for this adventure that we're going to go on across the stars, as it were.
Excellent. I'm glad that you're excited to be here. And I'm ready to drop that act because, hi, I'm Devin Decker, he's Sejun Sarawik, and you know us from the Say Report, more than likely, or you just stumbled upon us, in which case, welcome from either camp, right?
Yeah. No, and I also like the idea of dropping the pretense here that we're going to try to turn this into something fancier than what it needs to truly be. But yeah, I'm here. You are here.
We are here. The problem is, when you call yourself the Adam Sandler Cinematic Universe, you almost feel like you have to adapt that character, that like prim, proper, and museum curator, someone mm-hmm. who's getting Me Too'd by all the docents. But no, that's not what this is. If you don't know us from the Say Report, that's our other podcast that we do, and that's a show about everything. Seinfeld was the show about nothing. The Say Report is the show about everything. We'll talk about politics, sports. We'll even talk about Sejun getting a rash from the little tag in the back of his underwears.
This is not the show to talk about that, Devin. Please.
No, I understand that. But
that's what the Say Report is for.
That's what the Say Report is for. What we're doing here and what this is the topic of Adam Sandler came up a lot on the Say Report. And the biggest moment was when it was revealed that there might be an interconnected cinematic universe at play in all of Mr. Sandler's films.
Right. And it came as no surprise to us. Anybody that had been listening to the Say Report knew that we were fully on board with that theory long before.
Exactly. But because we were fully on board with that theory long before, once Hubie Halloween dropped and, you know, the world lost its collective mind over the mere mention of an interconnected cinematic universe in Adam Sandler's films, I don't know about Sejun, but I know that I was mobbed from people saying, well, then you need to define it. You guys talk about it so often. You think you're some sort of, you know, authority on the subject. Why don't you define it? Because they're going to need a roadmap.
All right, well, why don't we?
But the important thing is, what the goal of this is not to create the definitive or the only roadmap to the Adam Sandler cinematic universe. No, if you can buy a Rand McNally almanac or road atlas, I don't know, I had a bunch of them growing up. Did you ever have one of those just like books of roadmaps in your car?
We were big on the triptychs, the AAA yeah. triptychs stuff, where like they would map out your entire trip for you. Yeah.
Yeah.
They would like print out like a little like binded book for you. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, if there's enough room for AAA triptychs and Rand McNally road atlases, there's going to be enough rooms for different interpretations of what a cinematic universe of Adam Sandler's work means.
Sure. Rules are made to be broken, but first those rules have to be made.
So. Right. So we decided that we would create our own personal, like, rules and definitive Adam Sandler cinematic universe. As defined by Devin Decker and Sejun Sarawik, that's what you're coming on this journey with us to do. And in order to do that, we decided we needed to start somewhere, right? If you ever played the Oregon Trail on an old Apple computer, you started on the East Coast, heading towards the West Coast. We needed to find our East Coast.
I'm loving the metaphor. Sorry, I'm very much in on this because you very well couldn't start in Oregon, right?
No, you could. That'd be the shortest game ever. I mean, it's already kind of short because you get dysentery and you die before you're through Pennsylvania. How big is Pennsylvania?
Pennsylvania's the worst.
It's the worst.
Still is to this day.
It's still like, and I have a car that can drive 80 miles per hour, and it's still the worst. How is it 6 hours later and I'm still in Pennsylvania? That's not what this is about. What this is about is us crafting our roadmap to the Adam Sandler Cinematic Universe. And when it came time to start, what we decided to do was to look at films that had, let's say, overarching themes, plot points, or even characters.
Yeah, I mean, the ones that were most obvious. Like, we plucked the lowest hanging fruit from this tree, first and foremost.
Right, because if we get the low hanging fruit, we eat it, we level up, we can climb to those higher branches.
Exactly, they give us power.
And that is why we're starting with six films, and this is going to be the first exploration of those six films. But those films are, in release order, Billy Madison, Happy Gilmore, The Waterboy, Little Nicky, Pixels, and Hubie Halloween.
Yeah, and I will be the first to admit that it gets a little weird at the end, but I believe, firmly believe, that as we go through these first six movies, it'll begin, the roadmap will become clear as we slowly start to get to those. And there's going to be points where you guys are going to want to pull off, and we promise you, we will come back and visit those stops, but we got to get to the end of this road first.
Right. It is very important that we have an idea of the rough boundaries of which Adam Sandler Stan exists in order for us to set up, you know, all of the proper outposts and counties and, you know, sister cities. And right. That is why we have decided to start with probably the first Adam Sandler film for most people. Certainly the first film where he is in the starring role and the one that, you know, launched a bunch of films in his image.
Exactly. Clearly not the first time he was aware. It's not the first time we were aware of him. I mean, between a career on SNL and at least two films out before this, this is the first one, though, where you would call it star power.
Exactly. This movie was being sold on the fact that Adam Sandler is Billy Madison.
Right.
So, Seejim, before we delve any further into this, what was your first impression of Billy Madison?
Well, so, I mean, without getting too deep into, like, nostalgia territory here, Billy Madison is one that I saw, like, off the shelves of Blockbuster when it first came out. At the time, Major Video. But, like, so this is something that has been in my blood for a long time, which is, I think, going to be something we find with a lot of these movies. But, like, the idea being that Billy Madison is one that I could still quote you to this day. I still sing "Do You Have Any More Gum" to myself in the shower on a regular basis, like that sort of thing. So, first impressions were I was a little worried, and watching the movie, happy to say that it holds up in a way that a lot of other retrospective films you and I have done do not. So I was very, very pleased with my watching of this movie. Smile on my face still hurts. Like, yeah.
Yeah, it's this film, I was very excited to watch it again. And in watching it in 2021, God, can you believe it's 2021? And that's how you say it, right? You don't say 2021, you say 2021.
You only say 2021 if, like, you're trying to be a weirdo from the future.
Oh, okay. Is this 2021?
There are situations that call for it. What year is it?
What year is it, boy? But yeah, it's watching it in 2021. Admittedly, because a lot of similar cinema from the same time period, we've seen that it hasn't aged as well. And, yeah. You know, Adam Sandler, he's always kind of been a divisive figure, I feel. While people go to his films in droves and he is able to ink a deal with Netflix, at the time that this came out in 1995, you know, parents were warning their kids, like, you can't listen to Adam Sandler albums, or you're not seeing that because Adam Sandler's in it. He had a bit of a edge to him then, and if there's anything that we've learned in our tenure at the Say Report, edge usually translates to of the time and not aging very well.
Yeah, if you will allow me to kind of start diving into some of the figures on this one, because I think you've really got a good lead in there in talking about similar cinema of the time. See, that's not easy to say.
It's not. No, it's a tongue twister.
Yeah, but so to give a little bit of a context to what this movie is going up against at the time, there are two other I will call them bad boy comedies. We'll talk a little bit more and unpack that maybe a little bit later, because I don't even feel comfortable necessarily with that with Billy, and we'll talk about why. But the idea of there's a market for movies to 13-year-old boys, and this is definitely falling into it, right?
Yeah.
The two other movies that are out at this time are Dumb and Dumber, which had come out actually a few months previously, but this is back in the 90s when movies would stay in theaters for like 60 weeks and it wasn't weird. So Dumb and Dumber is still in theaters and is actually only a couple of numbers behind this on its opening weekend. And the other one that's out right now, Dev, that I didn't know until I started really diving into this is also around the same time that Jerky Boys is in theaters. How fucking crazy is that?
That is insane. The Jerky right? Boys, to me, I guess it's because I wasn't truly exposed to them until mm-hmm. at least the turn of the new millennium. So yeah. 2000, 2001.
That's crazy to me because every movie I rented in the 90s had a preview for the Jerky Boys movie on it.
Well, I mean, every movie that I saw in the 90s had a trailer for Dr. Jekyll and Mrs. Hyde.
Yeah.
I never knew that film released. In a back pocket of my mind, I thought that Tim Daly film was just like a joke that they put together to put on all these VHSs to like pad it out.
In the back of like television scenes. Yeah. No, Jerky Boys had come out exactly 1 week before Billy Madison. So
wow.
Jerky Boys was in theaters for a week before we saw Billy Madison, and Dumb and Dumber had been in theaters for about a month and a half at this point. And that's just those movies, because it also opens up the same weekend as another underground Say Report favorite that we have not quite talked about, but I will definitely love to talk more to you about. Opens up the same weekend as The Quick and the Dead,
ooh,
the Sam Raimi Western with Leonardo DiCaprio, Russell Crowe. Who's the lead in it though? It's not Kate Winslet. What's her name?
I don't know. I haven't seen The Quick and the Dead. So definite fodder for an episode of TSR.
Something for us to talk about. Yeah. Because it's all of the good Sam Raimi-ness of Spider-Man, but in a Western, and something to unpack at a later date. But yeah, so it opens up the same weekend as that. Shawshank Redemption is actually at the end of its run, but still in theaters. These are the kinds of movies that people have the ability to choose to see besides this. Quiz Show is still in theaters. Do you remember Quiz Show?
Of course I remember Quiz Show. So the question that I have, since we're talking about it, when did Billy Madison release?
So February 10th is the release date of Billy Madison, 1995, to put a year on it. Mm-hmm. So we are in that, what is at this time, I may be mistaken about the 90s, but at least when you and I were in our teens and in the 2000s and 2010s and whatnot, February was a dead time for cinema. That was when you put out the movie you weren't sure about, right?
Right, and the reason for that, and it's actually interesting when you consider that Shawshank Redemption is still out in the theater at this time, is because at the end of January, they're telling you those films from the year before that were Oscar worthy, and nobody wants to go up against a movie that got the stamp of approval of being good enough to potentially win an award.
Yeah. So
Shawshank Redemption is in theaters as a film that's going to be that's nominated for Best Picture.
I mean, and make no mistake, anybody that's seen Quiz Show knows that it's up there in those same
exactly.
ranks. We're talking about the tail ends of their runs. They have, I think, Quiz Show literally has been in theaters for 67 weeks at this point. If I remember, if I did the
crazy
math right,
like
that's nuts. It's crazy. It's been over a year since that movie released, but then they put it back into theaters to get you to watch it again for award season, because that was something they used to do too. And Billy Madison is I mean, for all intents and purposes, dumped out in February as just like an off chance this will be the thing to take the weekend. And sure enough, it does. It has a $10 million budget, which is pretty moderate for a comedy at the time, especially somebody's first comedy. Correct me if I'm wrong, but Lorne Michaels is in on this one, right?
I actually don't think Lorne Michaels is involved in this.
Weird. Like the rare SNL like breakout that doesn't have him. Maybe this is the thing that taught him he should have been. Because like Billy Madison ends up making off of a $10 million budget, ends up making about $6 million and some odd dollars back in his first weekend alone, goes on to make another like $20 million throughout its time in America, and then international doubles that. So like we end up on a thing that is by all accounts a blockbuster film because it makes its money back and double, triple, and then eventually five times. So like it's a successful little piece of film. Now, not to say that it was critically successful, pretty much across the board seen as just a kind of needless comedy. A lot of people just don't get it, and that's like a weird way of. Like I hate that. I hate that idea of like, oh, they just didn't get it. But like legitimately people scratching their heads in their reviews, being like, I don't understand what this movie's trying to be. Like there's an invisible penguin, there's a song in the middle, like what is going on in this film? And so like with that in mind, it kind of doesn't have like the critical punch that something like actually Dumb and Dumber does at the time. Which is an odd comparison, but like Dumb and Dumber actually ends up doing kind of gangbusters on a critic scale. And so like it's kind of in like the shadow of Dumb and Dumber. Billy Madison just can't quite live up to that. But both end up finding themselves in this weird place now in 2021 of both being kind of cult comedies. Because like I would say if I pointed at somebody in our range now and said to them, you like Dumb and Dumber? They'd actually have to think about whether or not they like Dumb and Dumber. And I feel like they'd kind of be in the same boat with Billy Madison. Like, they've kind of landed in the same spot in people's minds. And I think on both of them, inevitably people would say, yeah, you know what I actually do? But they'd have to really think about it first.
Which is interesting when you consider Billy Madison's success kind of stands on the shoulders of the giant that was Ace Ventura as the comedy that we're just going to fart out in February, and then it makes Jim Carrey a household name, and somehow we were ready to capitalize on that.
Yeah, and it's only been a year would be what I'd say to that, I guess. Yeah. It's like people, you know, people wouldn't expect that lightning to strike twice like it kind of does in 1994 and then 1995 for both of these actors. But interesting to really kind of look back now and see where they both went with their careers and what they decided to do and what these particular movies end up meaning to them as both being in theaters at the same time. I was very surprised to kind of take a look and see what other films were going up against it.
Yeah, that's insane. I didn't even consider that with a February release, it would be fighting for screen space and eyeballs against Oscar-nominated films.
Yeah.
One film that is still considered widely to be the greatest film of all time, right? I still think it's number one on IMDb based on user ratings. So, you know, yeah. Subjective, but still, Shawshank Redemption, it's like, oh, do we see Shawshank Redemption or do we see Billy Madison in 2021? That's kind of a no-brainer.
Yeah, just to throw a couple of other ones out there, just to make you kind of say, what the fuck, at the same time. other movies that are out, but they've been out for weeks at this point. Pulp Fiction is in theaters currently. Before Sunrise is out there. Street Fighter is out there. these are just, like, this is the movie, like, landscape of early 1995 when Billy Madison comes in. Like, a lot of movies that have people, that people still today talk about. You know, and everybody kind of talks about 94, which a lot of these movies I just named were from 94, as being kind of that, one of those last years where, like, we really kind of got a good, like, handful of cinematic, like, history-making movies. I won't say masterpieces on all of them. Street Fighter's clearly not that. However, to look at Street Fighter now, like, you'd be a fool to not talk about how it affected things going forward in, like, the video game movie landscape, the fighting movie landscape. Like, there's a lot going on in Street Fighter that's worth talking about, even though I wouldn't necessarily call it a masterpiece film, right? But, yeah, it's a crazy time for movies, is Adam Sandler decides to jump in at what might be one of the scariest moments in movie history to try and make a name for yourself.
Exactly. It's one of those situations where everybody else is making a name for themselves. Why not me? Mm-hmm. And so many people continue to thrive in an oversaturated market. And that's why the 90s is that time that we're all so nostalgic for. And in fact, I'm going to say a bold statement, and it's going to be difficult to prove, but for me personally, Billy Madison is the film that led to the $5 DVD bin at Walmart.
Because I could see that. Yeah, I mean, like, I could definitely see that.
Because my copy of Billy Madison I bought for $5 at Walmart, as like, I remember this film, it should be fine. And then that summer, I watched it till the tape broke.
Yeah. Like, yeah, I mean, it comes out at a time when VHS tapes still cost $80, and by the time it becomes the cult classic that we all know and love, by the time I am 13 and watching it on repeat on Comedy Central in the year 2000, right? That is about the time when suddenly you start to see the price of movies starting to come way down, because they realize there's some stuff out there that it may not make a lot of money up front, but if they can get a long enough tail on it, that's when you're suddenly going to start seeing a lot of, like, you know, maybe box office isn't all that matters. Now, they never fully come around and admit that, but that is definitely still part of the math nowadays.
Definitely. All right, so are there any other facts, figures, or impressions that you want to add to this?
No, man, I need you to give me a breakdown of what's going on in this movie, because we need to start talking about this movie.
All right, so according to wordcount.net, this Ooh. Should take about 2 minutes and 47 seconds. Because writing a synopsis, I felt like, let's go to Google, let's see how you write a synopsis. And here's a fun fact. Half the things I read said 500 words. Half the things I read said one page single spaced. Can I blow your mind real quick, Seijin? In this film that's about education? That's the same thing.
Yeah. Yeah.
500 words is one single spaced page. And I'm not sure why people can't just say that. Like, why everything I read was either 500 words or one page single spaced. You're putting a little slash there.
Well, this may be a little bit of a sign of things to come in the rest of the episode, but people learn in different ways, Devin.
That's a very good point. So, without further ado, Devin Decker's film synopsis of Billy Madison. Billy Madison finds the titular 27-year-old's world shattered when his widower father appoints another man, the immoral Eric Gordon, portrayed by Bradley Whitford, as the future head of the family hotel empire. To add insult to injury, it is also revealed that Billy's entire 1st through 12th grade educational experience was tainted by his father paying for his grades, which has left him ill-prepared to assume the mantle of leadership. Billy's solution? Complete the entire educational experience in a 24-week period, proving his capability as a man and the rightful heir to his father's kingdom. Coloring books and spelling bees mean the first 4 weeks are a breeze, but once Billy makes it to 3rd grade, he is reminded that this will be a more difficult endeavor than he may have realized. Luckily, the friendship of his 3rd grade peers and guidance of 3rd grade teacher and potential romantic interest, Veronica Vaughn, helps to keep him on track despite the various rigors of a public school education, made all the worse by the consistent meddling of Eric Gordon. Once Billy arrives in high school, he realizes how little he likes the man that he has grown into and begins taking the necessary steps to become better, with not only the educational credential worthy of his father's company, but also the mental and emotional maturity that he believes such a position requires. Unfortunately, Eric has found the perfect patsy in Billy's elementary school principal and disgraced former wrestler, Max, the revolting blob Anderson. Using the fact that as a wrestler he killed a man, and also may have perhaps lied about his teaching credentials, though the killing a man thing seems to take precedent, Eric coerces Max into saying he only passed Billy because he was bribed. As this is the same crime that Billy was trying to undo, it is easy for his father to believe it has been committed again, and he loses all faith in Billy, and this lack of faith derails all his efforts, allowing Eric to assume control of the company. Disgraced, Billy descends even deeper into his previous cocoon of daiquiris, Nintendos, and jack-off magazines, until a beating and catchy tune from Veronica Vaughn convinces Billy that no man will take what his father has built unless that man is he. Thus, in the true spirit of an 80s comedy, Billy challenges Eric to an academic decathlon to prove he has not only the educational fortitude to run the family hotel business, but is also better qualified than Eric. Once Eric is defeated due to a lack of business ethics knowledge, pulling a firearm, and a bullet of retribution, Billy determines that he would rather pursue further educational goals and go on to become a teacher so he can help prevent students like him from falling through the cracks, and appoints operations manager Carl Alphonse as his father's successor. Finally, in a truly Shakespearean turn, everybody also finds love, be they man, woman, or invisible penguin.
I first of all, kudos. That was some of the best writing that I, a person who educated college students for 10 years, has ever heard.
Thank you.
Secondly, I learned some things. There's a couple of things in there that I never really kind of caught in the movie, but like I'm really kind of happy you brought to light. Not least of which, the early point that you made that he discovers that his dad paid for his grades.
Yeah.
I don't know why that never clicked for me. Like, now that you say it, A, it makes sense, and B, I can now recall it, but it never sat with me.
Yeah,
and that's huge, right? Like that is a huge part of this, is of his motivation. Is it's not that he did this once before and he now needs to go back and do it again. It's that he needs to prove himself to himself in a way that, like, he doesn't ever really outright say in the movie, but like that is extremely interesting to me.
Good. I'm glad. I was afraid that may have gotten buried in all of the syntax, but yeah, 'cause that's such an important driving force of this film, and why I think that it's the fact that it's Billy's solution to retake first through 12th grade and then prove that he has, you know, that educational experience is so great and what makes this film stand out the way that it does.
Well, in a lot of ways, it also makes the inevitable fast forward that they have to do in the decathlon twist, where he doesn't really go through all of high school, because at that point we've watched an hour of a movie of him sitting through the funny parts of elementary school, but now it's not so funny because high school sucks for everybody. Like, and the film decides to take this other approach, this other swing at it in the academic decathlon that he partakes in, and it lends credence to that, the idea that he did learn something, his dad just never gave him a chance, which is something that he doesn't... I think the reason that it never clicked for me, and I'm okay with this, is he never seems to blame his dad for any of this. In fact, he very much loves his dad, which is like a driving motivation for him in a lot of this movie, is like trying to prove himself specifically to the father he loves. So he never holds it against his father that that's what happened. And so I think that's why it never really kind of like clicked in my head that was part of the deal, is because there's never a moment where he's angry with his father for what happened in the past.
Yeah. In fact, it feels like Billy coasted his entire life into the state that we see him in the opening of this film, because his whole life, his father and deceased mother, as as his father states, had always planned for him to take over the company. Right. So if he's told his entire life, this is your path, then why do you need to work for anything? And then anytime you come up against any sort of, you know, obstacle, your father just throws money at it. You're not going to develop those necessary skills to overcome said obstacles on your own. And then when all is said and done, the reason why his father is not willing to give him the company is because his father took away all of those chances to learn the very skills that Billy is missing in his eyes.
Yeah. Yeah. Damn. This movie's kind of deep.
Yeah.
Yeah, man. So, phenomenal. Like I also really appreciate, not shying away from just like just getting into what happens at the end of this movie with Max and the fact that he might have murdered a man in the ring. And I think, you know, the fact that it's the early 90s speaks to the idea that we don't care too much about his teaching credentials. It's really more about the fact that he probably murdered a dude.
Yeah, it's interesting. Like, that's, and yeah, because it's, he seems like he killed a guy, and that's when Max is like, oh, damn, he's got something on me.
Yeah, I mean, man, yeah. So we have a small section here dedicated to a very special thing you and I are going to do, and I'm very interested to hear what you're bringing with this.
I. So that's why I'm going to ask to go first on new, but second on old. And and what we're going to do now, it's an Adam Sandler Cinematic Universe, you know, not trademarked because, oh my God, do you know how expensive it is to trademark? But it's one of our own original adapted ideas. And that's a segment that we call Something New, Something Old, Something Borrowed, and Something Blue. Because if we're really going to look at these films as part of a grander universe, these are kind of bullet points to follow if we're going to, you know, map out the data correctly.
Correct. Yeah. Yeah, man. So what are we shooting for first? Something
new is where we're going to start.
Okay. And do you want to go first on that, or you want me to go first?
I would like to go first on, I'd like to go second on something old. So
okay,
I'd like to
fine.
Go first on something new.
The floor is yours.
And honestly, the something new, it's beautiful because this is the first film that we're looking at. And I'm going to take something relatively easy, but that will have grander implications going forward. I can't know 100% that fact, but it's just in my bones. And I think it's going to be the O'Doyle family.
Okay. Yeah. Yeah. The O'Doyles for sure. Man, stole mine.
Why do you think I want to go second on old?
No, so for the something new, I think what I'm really going to bring to this is the idea that he is, so it's the PG-13 comedy, and this really kind of solidifies, like, I hesitate to go back to something we talked about on the other show on Say Report, but when we talked about Ace Ventura, we talked very much about how it was not, like, I saw it as a kid and it was not a movie for children. There's stuff that goes on in that movie that's actually outright disturbing, right? And the idea with what Sandler does is he's creating these kinds of movies that he loved when he was a kid. And so what he's doing is he's creating the PG-13 comedy that welcomes in that audience. And it really does kind of set off, like, cinema going forward, what they try to do with the idea of PG-13. Because let's not forget, PG-13 barely existed for a decade before this movie. Even that?
Yeah, Temple of Doom is the first PG-13
film.
Right,
and so the PG-13 comedy that is geared towards adults, but with, like, a wink and a nod, knowing damn straight that they've got a kid in that audience that's 10 years old, right? And so he really kind of finds that really good balance that then every other fucking comedy for the rest of time, up until now, shoots for. And it is that is the something new that he brings to the table, is the true PG-13 comedy.
Dude, not only that, if we're going to talk about bringing something for everyone involved going forward from Billy Madison, it doesn't matter what your rating is up to PG-13. You're trying to placate the entire audience. Like, right. I don't think it's surprising that Toy Story, which releases this same year, is very much a kids movie that also has laughs and moments for the adults who were dragged there because I want to see the cowboy movie.
Right, exactly. Yeah. But the very well-balanced comedy in this movie, where I told you, like, I was watching this movie nonstop when I was a kid, and there was stuff I was watching today going, I didn't understand this as a child. specifically the business ethics joke at the end.
Yeah.
I had no context for why that was the one that he chose. I think what I thought was, oh, it's business and they're businessmen. Business is funny. Like, that was the extent of it. But the idea that it's business ethics that he calls him out on, and that's what sets Bradley Whitford off. It's like Eric loses his shit over that, and I never really quite picked up on that until viewing it at the age of 32.
Oh yeah, no. Until you're an adult watching Billy Madison, the question that is asked, like business ethics, is funny enough that as a kid you're like, oh yeah, ask the guy you don't think should be running the company about business. I'm going to laugh at that. But then the question with insider trading and the way that Wall Street has been revamped in the wake of it, and the responsibility of companies to, you know, protect themselves from such activity going forward, like, this is a guy we watched put his secretary into a coma because he threw a stapler in anger.
Yeah, which is supposed to be a joke. I'm not laughing at that because it's actually not funny. I'm laughing because that is a thing that happens in this movie.
Yes.
But yeah, so that'll be my something new, though, is the well-balanced PG-13 comedy.
Excellent. So what's your old?
So, I mean, the something old, this is something that Sandler is bringing to this thing. And it's the buffoon. It has to be. Like, that's the character that existed before this in both in his stand-up act as well as in his SNL persona and stuff like that. And it is a part of him that he is displaying here for 90 minutes. And he gets to let you fall in love with that character in a way that the 3-minute sketches before never quite allowed you. You always kind of like rooted for the guy, but you never quite fell in love with him like you do with Billy. But the buffoon is something that is not new to Sandler in this movie at all.
I bet you really like the water boy.
Yes, spoiler alert, but yeah, exactly.
Well, if you're gonna bring up the buffoon, Sejan, I'll stop. There's no more I can do. It's so hard to do the character of the buffoon in this setting. Because the stuff the buffoon says, you're not wrong. The fact that he does bring it forward into this film is impressive, especially on the heels of this is balanced, semi-family-friendly PG-13.
Yeah. Yeah. It really is. It is well-calculated comedy on a level that I don't think Sandler often gets credited with. And we are here for what other reason other than to point out the things that other people have never quite pointed out before.
Wonderful. I agree. Which makes my something old look like it pales in comparison to the beauty you just brought to the screen. But the something old for me is Chris Farley as the bus driver going, good, great, grand, wonderful.
Yeah, I consider that for another part of this list. But yes, yeah, man.
Because good, great, grand, wonderful is something that his security guard character says in Airheads. And if we're going to talk about a connected and Adam Sandler cinematic universe, there's a thread right there that honestly I was not prepared for. Either time I watched this film.
Yeah, I think it's really easy to point at him asking somebody like Steve Buscemi to come in and play this entirely silent role, right? Right? Buscemi doesn't. Oh, he has one line.
He has.
But like, other than that, like, I mean, Buscemi is an afterthought in this film. And I remember growing up thinking, huh, it's funny that Steve Buscemi plays this role for 2 minutes. Never thinking, like, previous to this was Airheads, in which they were like buddies. Like,
they're
they
brothers.
Were,
their characters are brothers.
Yeah, right.
Yeah.
Yeah. So there's this entire like relationship there that I just completely didn't realize. So that's like that's like the high thinking, the like element that connects it to Airheads.
Yeah.
Not remembering that fucking Chris Farley plays the phenomenal character of the security guard cop in that movie who has to go looking for the girlfriend, right? Like, that's his whole bit in that
movie.
That's
his whole thing. And then trying to get back in once he's located her. Like, it's this whole thing, and every time both times that I watched it for this, and honestly, Airheads was the movie that I saw more of because it was just on HBO more, like that summer of '94 that it
it's
came
also
out.
One of Chris Farley's best roles. I mean, yeah, that's the one where he like rips the dude's nipple ring out.
Yeah,
right?
Exactly.
Like,
yeah.
I fucking love that role from Chris Farley.
He's really, really good in that. It's like one of his meatier roles when you consider that, like, in Wayne's World, he's just the limo driver who gives the schedule. Like, he's an ex, he's a plot dump. In this one, he plays a role in Airheads. And every time I watch Billy Madison, it's just like, Oh, no, he's not going to say that line because that line's from Airheads, where he's playing a similar character of, like, kind of pushed to the edge, just doing his job. And then he says the same line, and I'm like, that's incredible. That's fantastic. And, like, it's not what I was expecting in the Adam yeah. Sandler movie film for also Chris Farley to be creating a cinematic universe where maybe in Billy Madison, he's that bus driver after quitting his job in L.A., or maybe after being a bus driver, he goes and becomes a cop and freaking just grenade pin pulls a dude's nipple ring.
Oh, man. Fantastic.
Which brings us to Something Borrowed. Now, Something Borrowed, for us, I just want to give just a little explanation of what I'm looking for when I do it. And that's things that existed in cinema before the Adam Sandler films, because the new and the old, those are things that are in Adam's family. Borrowed needs to come from somewhere else. So my borrowed for this is Back to School with Rodney Dangerfield. Because I feel like if you're Adam Sandler and you're like, I'm going to make a movie and I'm going to try to do it on my own, let's look at other things that comedians did. Rodney Dangerfield went back to school. How can we make that movie but not make that movie?
Yeah, I think the idea of the grown man surrounded by people younger than him is like it always played for laughs and to wonderful effect. I mean, we even saw like De Niro did it recently, right? What's the one where he like plays the guy that loses his job with Anne Hathaway and he has to go work at like the tech company or
the
something,
intern.
Right? Yeah, the intern.
It's
right?
A fashion like, I mean, company. Which exactly. Just like, let's make it, how much more 2016 can you be than De Niro loses his job in a factory and works at a fashion company with a bunch of young people?
Right. But like that bit is something that we love as an audience. And I think Back to School is the perfect one to point to because like the idea of him going in and teaching these young kids about what it's like in the real world, but also the young kids teaching him something too is definitely something that's present in both films for sure. Yeah, man.
and not to harp again on the beauty you brought in on the news section, but if you're going to try to appeal to everyone in the audience with your PG-13 movie, putting a younger dude in rooms with children, like actual children, is a great way to make kids feel like they're seeing themselves on screen.
Well, it introduces something that we see a lot in Sandler films going forward, and I don't even necessarily think this is like a Sandler universe thing, but something that he does really well in all of his films. And it is it's kind of the save the cat for Adam Sandler is the fact that he is always relatively good towards kids, right? Like it's the thing that kind of starts to endear him in a lot of ways. I think of something like Click, which is not on our list, right? But like a huge part of the heart of that story is how much he loves his children. And like the idea that he feels that the biggest thing that he regrets by the end of that movie is that he did not spend more time with his kids. And like that is like, and that's like the most on the nose one, right? Big Daddy is also another one that's like fucking on the nose when it comes to this. But Sandler and the way that he is able to work with children in a way that is, I mean, like, I look at Grown Ups, right? Like there's just a number of different films in which you can point to in which Sandler on screen with a kid is going to be guaranteed bank. And the idea that, he's able to, as I pointed out, the idea that he's able to balance that with, like, me as a 32-year-old watching this and not thinking that it's, like, weird, and it's definitely weird at moments in this movie, but it's acknowledging it's how weird it is and like it plays with that in a really intelligent way that like could get really creepy if it didn't acknowledge it. I think it goes really well.
I also think that what you're speaking of, that connection to children is something that if you saw this movie at the right age, you could kind of grow up with Billy Madison.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah.
And that's something I had never really considered until you mentioned, his affinity for working and treating these children not as just a child in the film, but as an actor that he is working alongside.
Yeah, I mean, he's not afraid to give these kids shit, which is noticeable in like every piece of trivia you pull up about this film, that in the dodgeball scene, he legitimately like apparently made some of those first graders cry. He was hitting them so hard. Like he's not treating them like kids on set. He's treating them like actors on set. Like he, you know, take for that what you will, but he is not afraid. Or I think specifically at the moment of the phone call when he's
With a
calling and he's like, "You screwed it up."
you blew it.
It, like he says that to that kid, like no doubt. It's amazing. Yeah. Oh
Wonderful.
man.
So what do you bring? What are you borrowing?
So well, so like I kind of went back and forth on this because there's a whole lot of old cinema stuff that he brings up in this movie. So like there's moments like the second when he grabs Eric and he's like, "I know it was you." It's
Godfather
like
Part Two? Yeah, like
totally, yeah, totally Godfather. Or oh, what's the other one that there's other references throughout this film and that are references to old cinema, right? But I think the thing that like I'm really kind of into is what you're getting at is the idea that he's going back to like old movies and really bringing concepts forward, like in like Back to School. I'd have to point to something like Arthur and like the idea of the spoiled man child, right? Like the guy that has enough money. And it's important for two reasons. It's important both in the sense of as a character, and lets you understand that he's never understood limits, but it also allows the movie to kind of have no limits itself. Because of the fact that they are as rich as they are in this movie, that the Madisons are as rich as they are, he is allowed to do pretty much anything, and you get it. Like there's never a moment where you question why was he allowed to do this?
That's very true. That's beautiful. Arthur is next level thinking about borrowing from older cinema, especially when you consider that Arthur's big, like, personal driving force is to get the approval of his father, which is really what Billy is looking for from Brian Madison as well.
Yeah,
That's.
but the spoiled rich kid is not a unique character in cinema at all, and this movie doesn't do anything to act like it is, I guess.
That completely changes what is probably one of the most iconic scenes of Billy Madison in my mind, which is shampoo is better. Like, 'cause Arthur's playing in a bathtub. You have changed this. You have given me new eyes to watch Billy Madison through next time I put it on. And for that, I thank you, Sijin.
Yeah. And the other big thing about Arthur that I think is important that we are going to talk about, we have to talk about, is that the other huge driving joke in Arthur is that he's drunk the whole time, right?
Yes.
And this movie like goes out of its way to hide the drugs that he must be doing. Any drinking you see, it's always Budweiser cans. Like you know what I mean? Like
It's
there's never any
Budweiser, daiquiris, and margaritas.
Yeah, there's never a moment where he's got a bottle of Jack Daniels in his hand, which is weird to me.
Yeah,
But there's also
especially
never a
with
moment where he
how
has like
drunk he
a
gets.
bong.
Yeah.
Right, yeah. How drunk he is, there's no way he's getting that off a fucking 5% Budweiser, right? Like he's definitely drinking harder shit. And so the idea that him and his buddies, I mean, the biggest moment for me that really that kind of like stood out that there was like a lack of any type of like harder substance is the moment when Norm MacDonald and it's not Artie Lang, is it Artie
No,
Lang?
it's
No,
not Artie
who?
Lang. I have no idea who it is. And I want it to stay that way. I love this dude. I can't think of another film that he was in. And he will always be the guy who's in love with the snot queen, spraying a hose at this
At that
random
kid,
kid.
at that random kid, and just laughing. But it is the scene when the two of them and Chris Farley steal all of the kids' lunches, and they're just sitting there, and the cutaway to them is just them laughing as they eat every lunch that these kids brought, and like, there's no explanation as to why they would do it, other than like we know so far that they're jerks, like, and but other than that, why are they there? Why is Chris Farley helping them? Like, what is going on? The second that you add a blunt to that scene, the second that you add a joint or a bong or even just like fucking just acid, anything to that scene that explains that they're out of their fucking minds at that moment, it makes total fucking sense. And so like the lack of it in that moment was actually more jarring to me than anything else.
Again, mind blown. because it's just not something that I ever considered with it. I'm sitting here thinking it's that damn Sasquatch, and now wondering what Sasquatch might be the code word for.
Well, right, we think she means the actual Sasquatch, but she just means the weed that she sold Chris Farley. another character that shows up later in the Sandlerverse, by the way.
I certainly hope so, but
she is supposed to be the same woman that shows up in Hubie that throws out all of the papers that he brings.
I'd believe it, but we'll get to Hubie eventually. What we need to do is I need to hear your Something Blue, because I'm pretty sure I know what you're gonna say.
So another one that I kind of struggled with, because there is some runners up for this, the casual misogyny that is throughout this film. You want to talk about like blue humor that doesn't age well, the not quite a mammy character that we have throughout the movie. I have to give my Something Blue that is like, that just does not sit well with me, has to be the running gay jokes throughout this movie for Max's character. I just think that like, it is not handled. It is in true Sandler fashion. There isn't a thing about it that I can say this specific moment is taking it too far. It's just so uncomfortable now, sitting in what we now sit in as a cultural moment, that I'm just like, this doesn't quite work anymore. I'm okay with the idea that the guy has the hots for him, and kind of a lot of the ways that Billy handles it is actually really mature. He's just like, look, this is great, and you're my friend, but like, this is just not for me, is generally Billy's attitude the whole time. It's just the fact that they make him such a character with that trait that it's kind of upsetting.
Oh, that is not the Something Blue I thought you were going to say.
What did you think I was going to go for?
For me, it's that blue duck, and that's really the only blue thing I can think of in this movie. But blue comedy, if that... Huh. Yeah, you're not wrong, though. The gay panic of the 90s in general, yeah. I think what is so disturbing about this, because the fact that exists in Billy Madison doesn't make Billy Madison persona non-watching. It's not like this movie should not be watched in 2021 because of this specific plot. Right. But when you look at Billy Madison, which is supposed to be this sort of more balanced, more family-friendly PG-13 offering that can be fun for the whole family. And, you know, Adam Sandler, we haven't really touched on it a lot, but he kind of takes shots at everybody. He's pretty bipartisan in who becomes the butt of the joke. I mean, Billy is not some sort of hero.
I would even venture to say that like 60 to 75% of the time, depending on the movie you're talking about, he is Sandler is the butt of the joke. Like that is huge for him in his comedy, is that he's always going to be the guy that takes the punches, which is really interesting.
Right. So then you look at the world that this film exists in, and the fact that the language of comedy, the vocabulary, everything that's existing, the gay panic features so heavily in the 90s that even a film like Billy Madison, where you really wouldn't even necessarily need it based on just the jokes per second on display in this film, it ekes in there. And I think where I would applaud Billy Madison is the fact that it is such a small portion of the film.
Yeah, I mean, and this is in light of later work that he does and things like, I mean, let's just throw the tiger on the table here. Like fucking when you start talking about things like Chuck and Larry, right? He goes back to this well in more uncomfortable ways. So like it's through that lens that it's hard for me to just kind of ignore it. And part of it is also like, I'm going to take a firm stance here and say like, just because everybody else was doing it doesn't mean you get to too. I you're not wrong. The gay panic of the 90s, especially the early 90s, was atrocious. And so like the fact that this couldn't even avoid it is not surprising, but I wish it had surprised me. I wish that it had gone a little bit further, because there is actually some really beautiful moments where he just kind of just blows it off, or like is kind of accepts it, or even the worst part, which is the moment at the end when the guy starts humping his leg. The thing that actually drew my eye that was actually not so upsetting was Miss Vaughn's reaction to it, where she was just like she just she was just like, oh, like he likes you. And like there was this weird moment where I was like, nobody in this scene is disgusted by what he's doing. It's just that what he's doing is a disgusting version of what homosexuality truly is. Like, so that like I am the only person in the room disgusted by it at this point.
Right, but also anyone else who's watching it knowing what
Right,
we know now.
right.
And it's, but it really is, especially, yeah, if we're going to talk about what is kind of the largest offender in this type of comedy, Chuck and Larry, it's good to see that like that's not something that punctuated his work right from the beginning.
No.
That he wasn't taking pot shots at that culture from the start.
And I will also say that, like, I am also willing to have the conversation. Not that I would probably change my opinion on it, but I am willing to have the conversation that Chuck and Larry is trying to break through that. Whether or not it succeeds is the conversation, right?
Yes, and that is a conversation for another time. But it is definitely a conversation that I think this show will eventually explore.
Yeah, but yeah, there you go. Are something old, something new, something borrowed, something blue.
ASCU patent pending.
Oh man, Dev. Like this movie though, like I am very, very happy that this is where we started. I'm happy that this is where we get to start. I should put it that way, because where else would we? I mean, like this is definitely the beginning for me for of the Adam Sandler universe, right?
I mean, it's hard to look at it and not say this is where it started, even though we see, small fragments floating through space-time. Billy Madison is a big, important movie. If it wasn't for Billy Madison, I certainly wouldn't have sought out Stan and Ju not Stan and Judy's Kid. They're All Gonna Laugh at You, or the second one, which I don't remember the name of, the one
No,
that has
yeah,
the Hanukkah
but
song on
yeah.
it, like.
So that's the other big thing that's happening at this time is that stand-up comedy is falling apart in the early 90s. Like people just don't know what to do with themselves. The idea of like the album is kind of becoming important, the HBO special is kind of keeping certain guys afloat, but other than that, like if you weren't pivoting to movies, if you weren't pivoting to the HBO special, you weren't gonna survive as a stand-up comic. And like, and I think that Sandler's really smart in that he saw that his shtick on stage, which was to tell a few jokes at his own expense and then pull a guitar out, that he didn't have enough steam to keep that going on its own. He needed the oeuvre like of Adam Sandler to like raise that part of his career. Because like there are plenty of guys at that time that would become the music comedian. I mean, even Dennis Leary had songs on some of his discs, right? Like there were guys at that time that could do the music bit, and there were guys at that time that were more than happy to tear themselves down at any expense in order to make a fucking buck. So like Sandler makes the really smart move here of like pivoting to film. And I think part of it comes from a love of film, right? Like we pointed out, like there's things that he borrows from all over cinema. Like he references things like The Godfather in his film, and like he looks back at old films like Rodney Dangerfield films and even fucking Dudley Moore and all that shit. And it's not an accident, you know?
Yeah, he looked at the people who had blazed that trail for him and decided, I'm going to try to walk that same path. And it's also not surprising that Adam Sandler would pivot to film, where so many people were looking at TV after the success of Seinfeld. And then you see things like Martin, Roseanne, Grace Under Fire, The Drew
Louis.
Carey Show.
Like, people forget that Louis C.K. at this time had a whole other show that fell on its fucking face
Right.
before we knew, like, the Louis C.K. that we eventually knew in the 2010s. Even guys that successful were still not able to pull off shows.
Exactly. So he saw that TV was an option, but based on his experiences in television, as covering on The Cosby Show, and his experiences with SNL, which are what it's well established, what drove him to film was, I can't keep doing this. It's the logical path for Adam Sandler to go to film, and this is his coming out party. Billy Madison is his, there's a term for it. it's a ball. I don't know. Coming out party is what I'm going to go with. It's
quinceañera. Like, his bar mitzvah, really, if we're talking about Adam Sandler.
That's...
But like this is... But this is his whole... This is his taking a chance at surviving, because he wants to keep doing comedy, clearly. He wants to keep doing, like, creative but silly work. He never tries to aim for higher cinema until he gets to a point in his own career where he knows he can actually achieve that. And I don't know if it's like because he was hesitant to. I don't know if he just never thought he could. I don't know what it is. But he has one of the most perfectly timed careers of any true, like, comedic actor, because every comedic actor eventually hits the point where they try a serious role. And if they don't, then it's just something they never wanted to do. But, like, he hits a point later in his career where he is doing serious film, and it works really well. And it's because he has this huge cushion to fall back on of just the millions of dollars he knows he can make in comedy. And so, like, this is really the start of him, like, learning that he can do it. And, like, it's kind of an attitude that, like, persists through the rest of his films. Is like, I know I got this.
Yeah, this is where Adam Sandler becomes self-aware. And since Adam Sandler is self-aware, Seijin, is there anything you think that we missed? Anything that you still want to talk about in terms of Billy
questions.
Madison?
Okay, yes. Yeah, specifically this movie. I got one big question. Are these public schools that he's going to?
Oh, definitely. These...
Yeah? Okay. In a weird way, that kind of means even more to me. Because, like, the idea that he bought his way in to go back to school, I was thinking they had to be private schools. And then I started looking at the state of some of the classrooms and stuff he was in, and I was like, these are not private schools. These are public.
Yeah. If what I focused on in these, like, adult, grown-up Devon viewings of Billy Madison is the fact that his father really took away every opportunity for Billy to grow as a child, what I noticed was, and even inside of that, he sent him to public school. Like, it's not like Billy was going to some sort of private institution that would have made sure he learned and became the perfect heir to a hotel chain, like, fortune.
Yeah, in a weird way, that would have been too hard. Like, it was much easier to just send him to public school and just pay his teachers on the side, right? For sure. Yeah.
Especially, yeah. I mean, let's look at what happened last year with Lori Loughlin and Felicity Huffman. That was 2 years ago now at this point, where, like, the bigger the name of the institution, the easier it is to get caught.
Yeah, man. And I think that kind of speaks to another thing that, like, I think is just kind of important about the structure of this particular film, is that he is a character. Billy is specifically a character with no struggle, no strife before, like, he realizes he wants to be a better person. And I think that, like, I think that that's something that doesn't necessarily carry through to a lot of his other characters. I think Sandler is very much a fan of doing the everyman, so it's really interesting in this particular movie that he is so distinctly not an everyman. Like, he is, in much that he has, like, the childish humor that we all kind of have, and I think it's a cute thing that he brings out in his villain, in Eric, is that Eric is just as bad as him. But that is something that I think does carry through, right? Whereas, like, the idea that he's the spoiled rich kid is not something that shows up in other movies. In fact, the closest we probably ever get to that again is probably Mr. Deeds. And in that movie, he specifically is not spoiled because he didn't have the money growing up. So he's actually this really sweet character that just ends up with a bunch of money.
Exactly. And we see how somebody who did go through those struggles and understands the human condition reacts once they're gifted such a vast sum of money.
Exactly. Yeah. So I think the idea that there is no struggle present in Billy's life is something that's really unique to this particular film. Yeah.
Yeah. Since you bring up Eric, right? Eric Gordon, as far as I'm concerned, is the Lex Luthor of this Adam Sandler cinematic universe. He's the Gideon who's going to spend like 2 hours tracking down Ramona's other six exes and put together an evil league to tear down the, you know, the continuum of Sandler characters.
The end of the next Sandler movie is going to be him bald on a boat and bringing in Deadshot, right? Like, that's going to be
that's how you do it. Yeah, exactly. It's just because there's something about Eric Gordon that is so inherently evil. And I think it's really important to this film, because when you have a character like Billy Madison, who, as you've brought up, doesn't really have any of the struggles of the everyman, you need to have an almost comically oversized villain in order to give him any sort of obstacle.
I would argue, though, that that is something that does kind of come through in the rest of the cinematic universe, right? Like think about Shooter McGavin. Think about I can't think of his name right now, but Gallagher's character in Mr. Deeds, he pulls the idea of the just douchiest white villain character all the way through into all of it. Like, he likes having a guy that you know is the bad guy. It's like when you first see Darth Vader on screen, you know he's the bad guy. He's in all black. He's got a fucking cape on. He breathes funny. Like, you know for sure that that is the embodiment of evil within this universe. And I feel like that is something that Sandler achieves in all of his movies, is there's always a guy that you point to and you're like, oh, you're the asshole, right? and you see other people learn from that eventually. And I'm thinking of like Joel McHale and Ted. Second he shows up on screen, you're just like, oh, you're the worst. Like that kind of thing. So I think like seeing this movie sight unseen without seeing any other Adam Sandler movie, he is something else. Like Bradley Whitford as Eric is kind of the secret sauce to this movie, because if it wasn't for a guy that's worse than Billy being on screen, Billy couldn't be the good guy, right? Like, and that is a key to this film, is that there is somebody that's actually worse than him in this universe. And it's like I was just saying a couple of seconds ago, the idea that he is able to show that his villains are as bad as he is all the time. Sandler is so good at taking the character that he has and pitting him against this pure evil, and then bringing that pure evil down to his level. Because, like, I think specifically, like, the dinner scene in this movie, early on, when he starts speaking, like, gibberish to him, and he's, like, and he shows him to be just the worst, and he's on the same page as him. He's, like, making faces at him and shit across the table. It's the worst.
Yeah, but the reason why it's not Shooter McGavin that I say puts together the Legion of Doom, it's not... I can't think of any other ones right off the top of my head. It's not Tim Meadows' character from Hubie Halloween, who's bringing everybody together in order to, you know, keep the Adam Sandler character down. And why it's Eric Gordon is because with someone like Billy Madison,
Ray Liotta, but I'm with you.
I forgot Hubie Halloween. I'm glad that we're going to have to rewatch it for this show. But it's one of those situations where, because Billy is, he's kind of likable, even though he's a buffoon when we first meet him, there's something charismatic about him. So you have to do that work very early on to make Eric so just distinctly evil. And it's not like he's some sort of evil land developer or anything like that. He's just ambitious, but he's a dick about his ambition. Why didn't you tell me about the delicious Triscuit crackers, Carl? Like, the bite
treats Carl.
Yeah.
The way that he treats Carl is the worst. Because Carl is on his side. At least with Billy, they're, like, up against each other. So, like, oh, animosities bring out the worst in people. But Carl is on your side, you asshole. Treat Carl better.
Yeah, right? Like, if you become the boss, Carl's gonna be a right-hand man. And this is how you treat him when, like, you're kind of his inferior? Like, I imagine that operations manager is probably ranked higher than whatever Eric did in the Madison Hotel Group.
I'm not gonna lie, I fucking love Carl. I've got like pages of notes about how fucking awesome Carl is in this movie. The moment when they're like, mano y mano, you don't even know what that means. So, do you? No, Carl? No, not a clue. Carl's just like, I don't fucking know.
It's when Carl cockblocks Billy and Veronica that is just seared in my brain, because it's such an important moment. It drives the whole force of the film. The plot moves forward because of that scene. And it's also just so ridiculous with the whole, and then he did that Weasley little laugh, that I don't know. It's but Eric Gordon, what I would say, and it's weird because it's the first movie that we're watching, and maybe that's why, but he is my Thanos of this universe.
Well, I think, let me take a swing at this, because yeah. I think what it is that unlike the rest of the Sandler movies, this is a group of characters. You have Billy, you have Eric, and you have Billy's dad, where, like, they have more money than God. So the idea is that they really truly can do anything. And that's what makes Eric worse than somebody like Shooter McGavin, who we're going to get to in the next episode. But the idea being that, like, Shooter McGavin's ambitions are because he wants more. Eric's ambitions are fucking pointless. Like, he has no real motivation behind being a true dick. And it's what makes him worse. Because he already is this person in this position. He clearly, you know, he's got money. What more does he want other than power? And so it makes him worse than somebody like Shooter because of the fact that there's not really more to be gained by getting this position other than just being the guy in charge.
Right. And I just getting one over on Billy. Like, if there was a 3-hour Zack Snyder directed cut of Billy Madison, yeah. I feel like those two knew each other when they were younger. And yeah. It's been like a fight between them their entire life.
Yeah, like Eric's dad worked for Billy's dad, and he feels like Billy's dad treated his dad like shit, despite the fact that his dad probably didn't feel like Billy's dad treated him like shit. He just saw it that way. Yeah, man, I completely.
I mean,
agree.
Like, if you want to talk like just real talk and just other things, because Chris Farley's already kind of on the table. It's sort of like Tommy and Richard in Tommy Boy, but yeah, you know, Richard friends. Is not yeah. fucking Eric Gordon. Who's a dick. Yeah, Eric yeah. is just a dick. I don't care that he's pregnant and that his child's going to be a soccer player. I hate you, Eric Gordon. I hate you. And if there's one law, one tenet, one commandment that I am going to stick true to throughout all of the Adam Sandler Cinematic Universe podcast, it is that Eric Gordon is a dick.
Yeah. Yeah, I think starting there with our rules for the cinematic universe, with Eric Gordon as first and foremost the biggest dick in the entire cinematic universe, I am okay with that.
Every villain is compared to Eric Gordon, which is going to be fun when we get to Little Nicky.
Yeah. Well, so with that in mind, I am going to put up my idea that villains are always shown to be as childish as Sandler's characters. Like, they are always brought down to Sandler's level is, I think, key. Like, it is his way of showing, like, the chink in their armor. Like, it is their weakness is that they are always, it's the thing that Sandler does where he's charming enough that, like, he can kind of bring out the worst in villains, and not like the worst as in, like, oh, the most evil, but worst as in, like, their most childish, their most immature versions of themselves. And we always see a moment of Sandler villains always being extremely immature, and it's always because they're at their end of the rope with Sandler.
Yeah. I mean, that's Eric's breakdown in this film, where mm-hmm. he pulls a gun. He's frustrated because Billy Madison has just weaved together an answer about the puppy that lost its way. And even though everyone in the audience is now dumber for having heard him say it, he still was able to answer that question that completely perplexed him from the start.
Yeah, sorry, I had to take my shot for hitting the meme, but that, yeah, but yes, yeah, yeah, that idea that he is brought down because of this moment, for sure. So, did you have any other rules besides your big one with Eric?
No, I mean, I've got a couple more. There are definitely other rules I think that are established in this film, but the big one that I wanted to put down on granite is that Eric Gordon is who I am. Every villain, every obstacle, because I do it. I do it without even thinking about it. I always consider, but was this person as bad as Bradley Whitford and Billy Madison?
Yeah. Well, so Sandler breaking through his villain's persona enough to bring them down to his level is, I think, key. I will say that I have two more that I think have to be written in stone. First and foremost, one of the big things that this movie does, and we have not given her enough credit for this, but Bridget Wilson as Veronica Vaughn, it, like, she establishes the leading female role in these films. amazingly well. And I think the thing that she brings to the table so well that I say it's going to be written in stone is the idea that leading women in the Sandler cinematic universe don't need him. As much as we can talk about the casual misogyny of the jokes and the idea that like he will do and say some things that are unacceptable to them, they, as women and as characters, never are in a position of needing Sandler to survive. They are always perfectly capable of standing on their own, which means that they choose Billy, they choose Happy, they choose these characters, and that is hugely important. The idea that a female character is not in a position to need the hero at some point, and so of course they fall in love because they got saved by this character. They're never saved. They're never damsels in distress. They are these women that are there and perfectly like capable of surviving on their own. Never mind needing a guy, and so they get to choose somebody as dopey as a Sandler character because they don't need him to be anything more than that.
Right, they just need someone who's going to make them smile, and that's sort of what he does. You want to talk about stereotypes perpetuated by the Adam Sandler cinematic universe? It's that girls just want a guy who's funny.
Yeah, but in buried in that, and that is definitely something to be unpacked, but buried within that is the idea that they don't need him to be anything more than funny because they're not depending on him for money, they're not depending on him for success. They are always, I can't right now, and I might be corrected on this down the line, but I can't right now think of a female lead that he has that doesn't already have an established career before Sandler comes along, right? And so there is this, and there's this beautiful moment that I realized. Because we talked about the pee your pants moment being kind of the moment that Veronica Vaughn kind of really realizes how much she likes Billy.
Yeah, we talked
You and
about
I,
that
you,
somewhere else, but
you and I, you and I have talked about that in the
yeah,
past. I mean,
because
but
it's an
like,
important moment, yeah.
and so there's this idea that is the moment when we finally see him kind of really care about somebody else, and that's what makes him fall in love and all that stuff. But it's actually really interesting rewatching this movie because she likes him before that. She is smiling at him, and she's being coy. There's other things that happen between the two of them. That moment, it's not like she hates him, and then that moment happens, and she suddenly is like, "Oh my God, I was so wrong about him." She's into Billy beforehand. She's realizing more and more that she might like this guy. That moment kind of gives her the go ahead. It gives her the idea that like, I wouldn't actually be like reaching into the fucking gutter with this guy. Like, there is something here that is actually worth like falling in love with. And it's what leads to the moment later on when she shows up at his house and she's like, "You're better than this. I know you're better than this because I've seen you be better than this." So like, it's actually legitimately like earned when she decides like, "I like you, and fuck you for not being the guy I like right now." Like, there's a sense when that first happens and you're first watching this movie where that feels thin. But actually, like the more you watch it, the more you realize she's always had a thing for him, and she realizes that there is good in him. So that is fair. She's a powerful and established female figure in this world, and he is fucking throwing his life away. And she shows up, and she basically gives him an ultimatum, and she's just like, "Look, I don't need you. So either grow the fuck up so we could be together, or I'm just gonna move on without you." Is essentially what she says in that moment, and she completely deserves to, and that's pretty badass. Like women in comedies, especially in the 90s. It didn't always get that kind of privilege, and I have to kind of give kudos to that. And I right now, I like I said, I cannot think of another female character that is not in that same position in the Sandler universe.
You know what else I'm going to say? I'm going to throw in my hat into the ring regarding what you've brought up about the strong, independent female lead in the Adam Sandler films. I also, at this moment, can't think of a film where her goal is to fix him.
Right.
And that is like, she's not a mother. It's not like this is a guy who needs me to treat him like an adult so he can be an adult. Which that is so important, especially when I look at other films that came out in 1995 that like I feel the message was supposed to be don't act like a man child,
Yeah.
but they were perceived the other way, and it's like just be a slacker and eventually you'll find a woman who'll be willing to take care of you and put up with your bullshit. That is not the narrative in any Adam Sandler film that I can think of right now.
Yeah, she has the most potential for that.
Yeah,
right?
Exactly.
Like, as a teacher and all that sort of stuff. Like she really is in a position where it would almost be the most justified if that did happen, and it doesn't. So yeah, for sure.
Yeah.
Yep.
That's awesome.
The only other thing that I really want to point out that is established now, because I think this is like one of the key tenets of Sandler films that we will see going forward, is the idea of, and I put this in quotes because I mean more than just this word, but this word is the best summation of it, is family. Family is always key in a Sandler film. And I mean that as like the spine of the film, you know, like on paper, but also in the ways in which he makes his film. Family to him is more than just like blood. It is his friends. It is the people that work with him constantly. But also, like, every movie deals with the idea that he is backed up by not just his dad in this movie, because his dad does support him in this film, but he is backed up by like friends that want to support him, and these kids that he meets, and Veronica when he meets her. So like there's this group of people that are always behind him, always willing to support him, always rooting for him. And I think that that's going to be something that we see Sandler carry through for the rest of his career, is like when he makes a feel-good comedy, PG-13 comedy that we all fall in love with, it succeeds because it's not just him on screen that we're falling in love with. It is the idea that like everybody within the world falls in love with him, and we love them. And it's a huge, huge part of this. So like collaboration is key in making a Sandler film, and family is something that becomes hugely important in every one of his successful films.
I agree 1,000% that family is such an important driving force behind what he wants to present on screen. I can't think of a movie right now, and it's probably because I've never seen the one that he did with Damon Wayans. But
Bulletproof, yeah, phenomenal movie. But okay,
I was gonna say and The Last Boy Scout, but that's wrong, right? I've never seen it, but I can't think of one where family isn't a theme, if not the outright plot, in some way, shape, or form. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, that's a. I love that. I love that family is something that we're going to focus on. And it starts right in the beginning as, who do we want to enjoy this film? And when the answer is the whole family, then that tells you the type of film that they want to make.
Yeah.
And what they want to put on screen.
Yeah. And I think that we're going to realize that that's kind of the reason why he never goes away, is because there is a lot of heart behind the stories in the movies that he makes, the actual like filming of the movies that he makes. And like he approaches everything wholeheartedly. And that is key for him and why he is still making the same kinds of movies now. And we don't see somebody like, I mean, Jim Carrey, like we said at the beginning of the show, like we're talking about a movie that was in theaters at the same time as Dumb and Dumber. And we don't see Carrey out there making the same movies that he was 30 years ago. But you better fucking believe that Sandler's like talking to Netflix about doing Billy Madison 2 or some shit. Like, you know what I mean?
I do. I believe I read that headline at some point. Though it's hard to wonder if that headline is just because we're all looking for a win right now or something that's actually happening.
I will put money down that it was Screen Rant and it was just based on something that one of the writers said they wanted to happen. But yeah.
Yeah, exactly. And by one of the writers at Screen Rant.
Oh, yeah.
Not necessarily. So I'm trying to think if there's anything else. I have a question I want to ask you before we wrap this up.
Shoot.
Jack Nicholson or Meg Ryan?
Jack Nicholson now or Jack Nicholson 20 years ago?
Jack Nicholson in Anger Management.
Oh, that's a hard one, because that would have put it around the same time. No, a couple years after Meg Ryan in You've Got Mail, right?
Yeah, it's about 5 years later. I think Meg Ryan's movie is Against the Ropes. If we're looking 2004 Meg Ryan against 2004 Jack Nicholson, I'm going to just fall in love with that beard 100 times.
I mean, as long as I get to be in the same hot tub as him and Kathy Bates, we're good.
Oh, man. About Schmidt. we're getting off topic. But it's fun. It's just, it's an interesting thing that he talks about Jack Nicholson or Meg Ryan. And then he got to act with one of them.
Again, another moment I will point to where, like, the idea of homosexuality is presented and it's not something that is then thrown away and discussed. It is legitimately considered and an actually, like...
It's not only is it considered, it's explored. With like, well, obviously now Meg Ryan, where she's young, but like, if it is, it a comparable Jack Nicholson? Is it Five Easy Pieces Jack Nicholson?
Oh, geez, if it's Chinatown Jack Nicholson, there's no conversation to be had.
Right, but if it's My Two Jakes Jack Nicholson, get the fuck out of here with that noise.
Too much power, man. It all went to his head.
Whew. All right, so I think that's everything that I have. Any final thoughts from you?
I'm excited to keep doing this because this was a delight. Yeah. That's all I'll say.
Yeah, watching these movies through a completely new lens, and I'm very excited about that. So if you've enjoyed exploring the Adam Sandler cinematic universe with us, we also do a weekly show. It's called The Say Report, and you can find it wherever podcasts are available. And if you have any ideas about Adam Sandler you want to bounce off us, you can reach Siegen on Twitter at Siege versus the World.
And if you have any thoughts about Jack Nicholson or Meg Ryan, you can find Devin at Devin D. Decker.
And until next time, remember, we don't know what the hell we're doing. We'll see you then. Thank you so much for listening to the Adam Sandler Cinematic Universe Podcast. If you like what you heard, you can subscribe so it's delivered straight to you. And why not write or review? If you want to get in touch with us on Twitter, we're at the ASCU, and you can always send an electronic mail to Adam Sandler Cinematic Universe at gmail.com. Thank you so much for listening. Apologize to your mother for me, and we'll see you next time.